Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour on this November the 17th on the West Coast, now November the 18th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. And I want to especially thank those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network and all those stations out there that are part of the network for broadcasting the show either live or in an archive. And I'm appreciative of all the kudos I got this afternoon as a last-minute substitute guest for Dr. H. Ru Watt when his communications broke down on his end. And I'm appreciative of the work that Drew Malone Raines is doing as well. I've got a lot to say tonight, and we're going to be getting into a very deep discussion about the nature of man and the nature of science and reality and all of those things. And I'm going to go right ahead and bring on tonight's guest. He hosts his own show every other Saturday, let's say, on BBSRadio.com. Station 1, the show is called Zero Point. His website is zeropoint.ca. He is a prolific author, written many books on spirituality and the hidden secrets behind that topic, as well as metaphysics. He is a practicing clinical psychiatrist, or should I say psychologist. He'll clarify that for us. And becoming a more frequent guest on this show, which I'm very grateful for, Christopher Holmes, PhD. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Don. It's an honor to be back with you.
Now, would it be proper to say you're a psychologist rather than
It's a psychologist. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor who then does a specialty in psychiatry on top of his medical degree, whereas a psychologist, it's straight PhD studies of psychology.
Yes. And you don't prescribe the drugs then?
No, I certainly wouldn't.
Okay, that's the distinction. No, I understand. Yes. Meaning, for some reason, I just spaced out for a moment because, I'm anticipating tonight it's going to be sort of a foray into the unknown. And I'm looking forward to it, and I know many of our listeners are as well. So pardon my excitement.
Great. And you've got some interesting clip to play, too.
Yes, I do. This afternoon, I had the opportunity to talk about all the stuff that's wrong in the world. And I've often told my listeners and the listeners on the other shows where I'm a guest that when I have something good to report, when I have something good to talk about, I'm going to do that. And often it's something that I find in the arts or in music or it might be some great invention or some great idea that someone has. And not necessarily on the basis of its financial value or potential, but on the basis of its spiritual value. And I came upon a young lady. She's from Carrollton, Texas, 7-year-old Rayma Marvan. And she has some videos posted on YouTube. And you can tell that the first few videos that she published were sort of like dry runs in a recording studio, almost like an audition, if you will. And in the acting field, it's more like a screen test. But in this case, I think it's a combination of getting her on tape, seeing how she sounds, and she was quite remarkable. She posted the Whitney Houston version of the Star-Spangled Banner, And then she got into more serious music. She began to get attention. Now, think, this girl is 7 years old. Her mother passed away from third-stage ovarian cancer a couple of years ago, and she's handled it marvelously, as much as a young soul can understand the difference between life and death and what impact that's going to have on her. But she inherited some talent from her mother. There's no doubt about this. And she has a very loving father. And I always speak about, and you do as well, about thinking and acting and being from the heart, focusing on the heart rather than on the head. And often a message in a song or the music itself, it can be an instrumental as well, that moves people to the point where it causes them to open up their hearts. And I want to begin this show giving everyone the opportunity to, first of all, listen to this angel sing, and then allow her to open your heart for you. And I think you're going to get a lot out of tonight's show with our guest. So, Christopher, if I may, I'm going to share the music of Rema Marvan. This is a song originally recorded by Andrea Bocelli and Celine Dion, a duet called The Prayer.
Let's go.
Rayma Marvin, 7 years old, from Carrollton, Texas. If there's any doubt in your mind that there's a God, that's living proof. Christopher,
how beautiful.
Any comment on that? You see why I played the song tonight.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as you say, it's about opening of the heart. And when we hear music like that, it's something intrinsic to being human. It moves us and we feel more deeply. That's what people need. We need to hear that type of music more, whereas so much of the modern music is so disharmonic and chaotic and angry and... You know, this is inspirational music. Like they say, the music soothes the soul. I've been listening to Botticelli lately too, because I like his singing a lot. It's beautiful. What, 7 years old? What, little angel, eh?
Yeah.
It shows you, Don, like what capacity human beings have. Like the genius or beauty, all these talents and such that human beings have. And it's so tragic how in life, like, that people have so little opportunity for self-expression and to realize themselves, like their true nature, and to learn to live in the heart. So many people are traumatized and...
Mm-hmm.
Through life, and we mystics describe how we become knotted about the heart. Like the idea is when we're born, like if you look at an infant, you know how an infant, they're gleeful. They can look like they're in a state of blissfulness just being and finding like glee in the smallest things. Well, in my understanding, like when we're born, our consciousness still resides more in our bliss sheath, which is the size of a small grape, and it's associated with the heart, and it's like the spiritual heart center is the bliss sheath. That's why if someone's awakened in the heart, you feel filled with blissfulness.
Yes.
That's the nature of the spirit soul, is this kind of blissfulness. So we, as we awaken in the heart, we can abide in that blissfulness.
Yes, I agree. This young lady, if you could see her, demonstrates what you just said just in her body language, her gestures. She sings with her hands, and she intuitively knows how to move her hands. No one could teach her this. She's just doing it. And the smile on her face, and the smile on the faces of those that listen to her, even the studio musicians. You know, these are excellent musicians, very well-produced production, but it's not stepping on the talent that she has, you know. It's accompaniment. It goes along with her instead of overpowering her. It's not the background music that makes her sound like she sounds. But she's made, she's more than a singer. She's a messenger.
Yeah.
And it's the delivery of the message and the sincerity and the passion at such a young age. It can only be from God, you see.
Yeah.
That young lady is going to probably become one of the most famous singers in the history of the world. I will make that prediction. That's how talented she is.
I hope so, and I hope she can retain that purity and pureness of heart. And if she still has it at seven, like she's, you know, by seven it's kind of fixed, a certain thing, qualities can be fixed in someone, and she's certainly off to a good start. Did you ever see, Don, that video of that woman, an elderly woman in England who went into the Stars, you know, where they pick the musical stars, and she was like about 50 years old and kind of heavy, and she went out on stage and everyone was kind of like laughing at her because she seemed so out of place with all the young people, and they were kind of mocking her, and then she sang her piece, and the first sounds of her voice, It was absolutely thrilling. It was like beautiful, like a Celine Dion or mm-hmm. Sarah Brightman. And it just like even Simon, you know, Simon, that kind of negative critical guy. Did you ever see this video?
Yes, that's you're speaking about Britain Has Talent and the competitor was Susan Boyle, who ended up winning. Did she win or come in second place? Anyway, she became famous after that.
Yeah, I mean, that was similarly moving experience because she had, like, here she was, like, she didn't look like what she should look like fashionable and slight, and instead she was this kind of matronly person but had this unbelievable voice and purity and sincerity to her. It was amazing. And then just how within a few seconds you could just she won the turned the audience like within
they
2 to 3
yeah.
seconds of opening her mouth.
Yes, they applauded immediately.
Yeah.
Well, see, that shows you, that demonstrates something that I'm often talking about, and that's this mission of controlling the world by tricking them into a dependency on idolatry. You see, how someone looks determines if they're good at what they do.
Yeah.
That's not true. And if you look at the Illuminati, none of them are anything to write home to mom about as far as looks are concerned. You know,
no,
so
they're not. In fact, they're
quite
they
the
look
opposite.
Their part.
No, you write home to mom.
No wonder they were after blood. You know? See,
exactly.
They try to live off the soul energies because in a way there's something so deeply pathological about them in their hearts
mm-hmm.
that, yes. That they're, Gurdjieff would call them terrestrial nullities. Is the term he uses. It's like they're empty inside and they like gain significance by owning things, for instance. Like you have to own, and the more you own, it gives you some inner significance or you have power over people. Mm-hmm. You know, they pursue these kind of material goals trying to fill the emptiness within them.
Yes, and that's all supported by a lot of illusion, you see. This
yeah.
idea that if someone is beautiful, if a woman is beautiful and she's singing, therefore she's a good singer. Her beauty is somehow compensating for her lack of talent. Now, that's not always the case with singers. I can name a lot of very beautiful women who are also beautiful singers. But the point I'm making is that we're forced to accept this lower quality. I've yet to hear anyone who's been on Star Search that shows the ability, the natural ability, or American Idol, the natural ability that this 7-year-old girl has, because of its purity and its innocence, in one respect. But she does everything technically correct as well, and with the limitations of a 7-year-old. Physically, she's at a disadvantage, and yet she can hold phrases that I've not heard many opera singers be able to hold out.
Yeah.
Long passages in one breath.
Yeah.
And effort. She shows no sign of straining on, you know, to see her on video is something, too. To see the physical command she has of what she's doing, it's so extraordinary. Oh. Anyone who's taken up music, some of you out there, 50 years old, 60 years old, and you say, well, you know, it's too late in life, I can't learn it. No, that's not true. This girl is an example of what we're all capable of doing. It's never too late, is it, Christopher?
No, it's certainly not. And people in through life kind of crystallize false personalities in a way and become more and more fixed, and in a way people through their life do become more and more deadened. In a way they become more and more like zombie-like or purely mechanical. But even those people, there's always kind of hope that something might crack that outer shell and help them to recover themselves, their lost souls. Like, sure. I see the elites, these people with this New World Order rubbish kind of. It's like they have no hearts, they have no feeling for other people. In a way, they're a lower evolutionary level, and they can't understand people of heart. Like a person like yourself, I mean, I can't speak for you because I know you as a host on the show, and myself, like, I couldn't imagine doing the deviousness of the things that they do, kind of. Like, imagine, like, spraying everybody with poisons from the sky and kind of thinking you're so clever and you have all these deviant things. And it's like their whole life revolves around having all these kind of deviant plans to manipulate people, impoverish people, poison people. Like, mm-hmm. What kind of being is that? Like, there's something truly alien or inhuman about it.
Yeah,
in a way, the elites are pathetic. Like, they really are. They're really degenerate, pathetic beings. Mm-hmm. And they've attained this kind of power. I mean, mostly because normal people who live more in the heart can't comprehend that level of evilness that they embody. Like, it's beyond our comprehension. Like, people can't believe, well, why would anybody spray us with chemicals, you know? Well, they believe in genocide. Oh, you know, people can't. It's beyond them. They can't, yeah.
Yes, well, you're making a very distinct point. I mean, whatever happened to picnics and festivals and celebrations? And, you know, with pureness of heart, For the simple pleasure of having a good time and enjoying life, experiencing something positive, something that expands instead of contracts, something that creates instead of destroys, something that awakens instead of induces a catatonic state, something that inspires instead of discourages and corrupts. Whatever happened to that? You know, that used
they've
to be
done so. Everything they possibly can to deaden it and destroy it in humankind through, in my view, the corruption of the educational system, the corruption of the media, Hollywood with all its deviancy and, like, insane movies. And they've done everything they can to try to degrade human beings. They want to degrade people as much as possible. And you see it, everything from the scanners and everything. They want to degrade people. They can't stand that purity of heart. They see purity, they want to possess that because they're of their inner emptiness, their inner nullity.
Yeah, but they could easily just mirror it or mimic it or copy it, you know, somewhat like a mime would. And yet at the same time, when they think they have that power, what do? They trash it. They flush it down the toilet. They'd rather get off on putting poisons in the drinking water, poisons in the foods, toxins into the atmosphere, poisons and toxins in the alleged medicines that are supposed to affect cures on people. The corruption in the banking system and in the international corporations and all the tangential businesses that they've created off of those, and including the plundering of our families and children and our own personal assets and our public assets. I mean, there's no end to what they do to us in all these different ways, usually just for financial gain, to capture more of the illusion that they feed us. They just have a lot more of the illusion than we do. And I know in your your studies and your writings about Gurdjieff, he addressed those issues, didn't he? I mean, he was point blank describing the scientific community and government and politics and the fields that are supposed to be dealing with all of these issues in a positive way. What do you have to say about that?
You know, I sent Don, I'm just a copy of my book called The Slugs, on G.I. Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, and which is a study of this classic book of modern mystical literature by Gurdjieff called Beelzebub's Tales. And it's an interesting book because in the book, he's on a spaceship, and he's traveling. Beelzebub was a character who was supposed to have been banished to the planet Mars, and he set up a telescope there and a colony of people from his former solar system. And he lived in our solar system for years, and he visits the Earth at all different times during human history. And the first at the time of Atlantis, and the last, the sixth visit, was at the time of 1920s America. And Gurdjieff, one of the main themes of the book is what are the causes of war, which he describes as this phenomenally arch-criminal kind of process. He calls it the process of reciprocal destruction that is always going on among those three-brained beings on planet Earth. Like, how did their being existence get to such a low level that they could periodically go out and mass murder each other? And so partly the book is this kind of view of humankind, and Gurdjieff talks about the role of what he calls husnamus individuals. And the closest thing in modern psychology would be the talk of psychopaths, but he defines a husnamus as someone who experiences no being shame or objective conscience. So it's in a way these people who have lost this intrinsic self-feeling that should be associated with people's hearts, and it's people who have that. And so then he describes them as having a spectrum of vibrations, of impulses, which he calls a husnamus impulses. And one is like, the first one is every kind of depravity, conscious as well as unconscious. And another one is the irresistible inclination to destroy the existence of other living, breathing beings, or creatures, sorry. And he has other ones. And it's like, in a way, that's what the elites are. They're the husnamuses. These people have no objective conscience and no being shame for the shameful things they do.
Yes. Now I have to be honest with you. I skimmed through the book just because of time, and I know you don't give me deadlines when you send me these, but I do like to know the topic. But, you know, your description is really what I talk about on this show a lot of times. I mean, I could say it in a different way. I could say, read Major General Smedley Darlington Butler's War is a Racket. That's on my website. You can go to directlightproductions.com and go look for it. It's on documents, on the documents page. So we've heard that message from different places, is what I'm saying. But what I find interesting, and I recall reading about this husnamus, and I said, well, that's what's going on. So why discount what he's saying? At least he's identifying that it's happening, you see, regardless of what you want to call it. It is happening, and he did see that happening, and he did look at it carefully enough, and he was very critical. Now, the thing is, what do we do with that information? Obviously, it's describing insanity, okay? That we're being run by people who are criminal element and are clinically insane, or maybe even beyond that, because I don't think you can cure this through their means, through conventional means. So we really have to wake up and realize that this is just a game that's being played on us. This is just an illusion, really. And to discover our inner power, and connecting with the universal power is probably something that would work in overcoming this, wouldn't it? Any thoughts on that? Maybe I'm just rambling, but
Well, no, I mean, I absolutely agree that we need to connect to that universal power, and I think that has to do with getting back to the heart consciousness and cultivating feeling and higher emotions are experienced through the heart. Gurdjieff, in terms of talking about human beings' transformation, he says the most important thing is like remorse of conscience. Like if a person wakes up, like you wake up in your life and you kind of look back at your life and you can say to yourself, my God, like how could I have been so selfish and preoccupied and done this and that thing? Like, and you can experience remorse of conscience.
Okay.
So Gurdjieff explains that remorse of conscience, he says there are different sacred being impulses. Faith, hope, and love are the traditional three. And then he has this fourth, is the capacity for objective conscience. And he says that is in our true consciousness. But Gurdjieff explains that our true consciousness passes into the unconscious. And a false consciousness system is created, which is more the product of artificial education and external influences. And that comes to dominate. And then people more and more can do things without conscience because this isn't awakened in their hearts. Whereas those of us on the mystical path, in the way we wanna face conscience, and through that Gurdjieff describes it as a fire that burns away impurities and frees the spirit soul then.
Yes. Now, I haven't read enough specifically to quote something that he may have said in this regard, but in terms of a belief system, any belief system, you know, an acceptance that a statement is true or that something exists because someone says it is, okay, as from a position of alleged authority to say that and to somehow enforce that or force that upon another being. I look at the word belief and I see two words hiding inside it, be and lie. And the word be lie, you know, the word between belief and believe is just the V-E on the end replacing the F. It's the action of belief. Be lie of an appearance, we could say, or fail to give a true notion or impression of something. Disguise or contradict, fail to fulfill or justify. You see, when you look at the meaning of that word, or the Old English version, is deceived by lying. So the word belief begins with the word be lie, or the word be lie, which says to deceive by lying. Then our belief system is all based on lies. It goes to knowledge. Now, I know that Gurdjieff wrote about knowledge and the importance of being empowered by knowledge and not belief. But can you give us more specifics on that?
I remember one of the earliest things that attracted me to the Fourth Way teaching was Uspensky's statement saying, this is not a way of belief. Believe nothing. He says, you believe something, it's of no value to you. He says you want to acquire knowledge, and that knowledge has to be substantiated in your direct experience. He says belief has no part of this system, and I'm the same. I don't want to believe in things, like imaginary things. In a way, I want to come to being myself and knowing what I know through my own experiences and direct sensation and knowledge. So as much as possible, we don't want to believe things and be full of beliefs. In a way, we want to strip that away and get back to what we really know in our being. So the Gurdjieff system, in a way, would help to strip away all a person's false beliefs. And Gurdjieff sees the educational system as simply training people to repeat things parrot-like. And he describes all the rubbish accumulated through centuries in human mentation. Like you go to school and you get all this rubbish which has been accumulated by all these hustle-muss individuals through history, you know. And it's all these wrong ideas and misguided notions and theories, and you become so filled with ephemeral knowledge, none of which has any reality to it. And that person is kind of like full of belief.
Yes. So, now, I want to comment on something you mentioned too, because in the slugs, Gurdjieff is speaking about Beelzebub, and it brings to my recollection Milton's Paradise Lost, where he names the three entities that who was the chief musician and the leader of the fallen angels, being Lucifer, and then what Milton said was in his transitional state between his existence in heaven and his transit to earth, where he was recognized as Satan. So he went from Lucifer to Beelzebub, and that could have been Mars, which was also known as the planet of war, and then the earth, which is, I think, far surpassed anything they ever did on Mars, to tell you the truth, and are fixing to do again. Do you see the possibility that Milton was actually right, that he knew that secret? Or maybe it wasn't a secret. Maybe it's a secret now.
I don't really understand. Like, in Beelzebub's tales, in Gurdjieff's book, Beelzebub is a character who was like higher individual and in a higher world, and he kind of interfered in the operation of the cosmos, and he was banished to the our solar system when mm-hmm. he took up residence on Mars. So in a way, he was a fallen angel, but in the book, really, he is someone who has attained higher levels of objective reason. And at the end of the book, when he kind of returns home or to this planet, and he meets this kind of most high sacred individuals, his horns on his head start to grow. And every time they grow, it's an indication of the levels of objective reason he attained as an individual. And he kind of attains this highest kind of level of objective reason. So although Beelzebub is often taken as a term to refer to like some satanic or Luciferian character or the Lord of the Flies, don't they say Beelzebub's Lord of the Flies?
Yes.
in a way, there's none of that association in the Gurdjieff tale. Instead, Beelzebub is really this kind of elder who's had centuries of experience and attained higher reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I wanted to get your input on that, because he really didn't explain it. It's sort of like, I guess, it becomes part of your consciousness to realize what that or who he might be. But, you know, having that prior experience of Milton influenced that thought that, it could be the same individual, could be a different stage of that individual. Some would argue that Lucifer still is in heaven, in a way, almost like his gifts have been imprisoned and he's been banished without those gifts to another reality, say the solar system. Certainly our space friends know about this story, and they also know they know Christ as well. He's visited all their planets, so there's a lot of discussion that could come out of this. I see your book, The Slugs, and your analysis, and just studying Gurdjieff's quotes and the statements that he makes about the different realities. It's a workbook. It's actually a workbook. This book could awaken someone if they really got into the meaning of what he's saying. Any thoughts that you want to share along those lines?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's a profound book. It's really subtle. I mean, Beelzebub's Tales is immensely difficult. It's like a 1,250 pages, and it's written in such a different kind of language But I, as one, like I've read it different times through my life, and every time you read it, it's like it develops something in you, even being able to read it, his mm-hmm. text. And the way he captures the essence of people in like two or three words, which is just like, I just so, it's like a master of language. Like yeah, you might talk about, for instance, like how someone would huff and puff. And that would be it, huff and puff. Or he would talk about he talks about courts at one point, and he talks about how there they have the old fossils. And and he talks about all these power-possessing beings and how they're under the thumb of their proprietors, whether it be their wives or their mistresses, and how whoever they're under the thumb of, that woman has kind of detected their inner insignificance and ferreted them out like a weasel. he uses such language. It's such a kind of otherworldly book. It's a remarkable book, and The Slugs is like the profound, it's the only book in the world that's an interpretation of Beelzebub's tales. There's nothing else. There's a collection of essays on it by one of his students, Bennett. But this book is like so difficult and so otherworldly that there's kind of no commentary on it. Even though actually I've just discovered a site through the internet where someone else has written a book on the tales, so I'm going to research that. But The Slugs, it can give you like profound insights, not into yourself, and also, I mean, it deals with this whole idea of the science of the soul, and Gurdjieff explains that, like, human beings don't automatically have a soul. We have to attain it, and that means to develop the higher being bodies, which should be called, he calls it the astral, the Kesjan body is his term for the astral body. And then he refers to the highest being body, which would be the mental body or spiritual body. So Gurdjieff says that we have to develop these bodies through our life. Otherwise, at death, he says a person can die like a dog, which means that when they die, their body kind of goes back into the earth and a certain energy passes to the moon, but they don't attain to these higher levels of possible human evolution that we might attain to. So it's like if you put nothing up in your life, nothing up in store for heaven, then at death, like, you just, you know, he describes people as fertilizer. Like, you go back, you feed the earth, you feed the moon, but you don't attain your soul. You don't attain your real I, which is the kernel of your essence.
Yes, so then we're operating under the false I, or the false ego. The ego exists, but it's not really who we are.
Gurdjieff describes people in their normal state as not properly conscious, like not having attained true self-consciousness. And he says how normally all people know are little I's. Like, I like this, or I hate that, or it's always like this different, a myriad of eyes, like in the Bible, where it says, Christ says, man's name is Legion, meaning that you've got all these different aspects in yourself, which have been conditioned in different situations. You're not a unified being. You have no singular I. All you know are these little eyes, and they're always changing. And you tell someone you love them, but 5 minutes later, you can't find your slippers beside your bed, so you hate them, and then they don't want to be with you, and you resent them, and all these different eyes. You know, I love, I hate, I'm pissed off, I'm desire, all these changing eyes all the time, but people don't attain real I. And that's what Gurdjieff is saying a person has to do in their life, attain real I.
Yes, I agree, and yet so well said. Of course, you wrote the book, so you have to be able to communicate it. You know, I want to get into the particulars of how our listeners can get a copy of this, but not at the moment. I certainly don't want to disrupt this vibe here, but don't allow me to forget, okay? hearing, you know, I'm just speaking from my heart here and throwing these concepts out. You know, some of this is influenced by what I've read, but I can tell people, I described this a few moments ago as a workbook, but that doesn't mean you have to work per se. It's we call these types of books that can lead you upon a path. I don't care if it's a science book, a music book, a math book, a coloring book, and if you're attempting to gain knowledge or develop a skill or develop yourself and empower yourself, then you have to be willing to at least consider what someone who has spent his whole life doing that. And I wasn't speaking about you, Christopher. I was speaking about Gurdjieff. However, it applies to you as well. You owe it to yourself to at least attempt to open up and consider that this all might be true, that there is actually a way for you to become powerful. And in doing so, you empower everything else in the universe proportionately. So in terms of work, it's a serious issue, and you're not going to get paid by a boss, but you don't have to punch in a time card. You just focus the time that you devote to studying these materials, and you'll see that if you skip around in the book, you're going to miss some things. You're not going to understand some things. You start from the beginning and contemplate. You could literally do a meditative session on each of his axioms that Christopher has put in this book. They are profound, and they cause you to think and to search for situations in your life where these things were being played out, and maybe you didn't know it or notice it, or you didn't understand why it was happening or how it was being done. And you discover something about that in respect to yourself, and you immediately become empowered, and then you move on to the next step. I found that just reading from the beginning, Christopher, it expanded my own consciousness. And I consider myself a little conscious, you know, but I see the impact and the power that's behind this teaching. Is it the end all to self-development? No. But speak about his religious background, if you would, a little bit. Not that we're singling
or... Well, just to respond a little bit to some things you said there, is the good of everything I've studied in mystical teachings, and I've studied in the area now for over 40 years, and I've studied widely, there is nothing as practical and useful to an individual as the Gurdjieff teaching. Now, I have a book on Blavatsky's secret doctrine, all on creation physics, eh? But in a way, that's not practical, or in the same way, or the studies of yoga, the study of Kabbalah. Like, these things don't have the practical nature of the Gurdjieff teaching. It is the most valuable system for self-study with specific methods and teachings about what to do. Like, what do you do to awaken? Like, everybody has the, well, we have to awaken. The man is asleep. What do we do to awaken? Gurdjieff answers that. Like, he gives a model of what the parts of our being and the levels of consciousness and how we have to work on ourselves. And it's an amazing teaching, immensely valuable. I can't imagine having had life without it. I mean, I was privileged in a way to be introduced to it to 40 years ago, and to have practiced it through my life. And in a way, it changes life because it helps to wake us up. And if our consciousness is different, then life becomes different for us.
Mm-hmm. Now, and the second half of that was about his thoughts. And I don't mean
religious,
organized religion, but the, let's say, if we talk about prophetic beings that came here, on the prophets, the holy prophets, or the concepts that those prophets brought forth as teachers, rather than shove a religious viewpoint down someone's throat, I'm leaving this open to each individual in a spiritual context.
What's interesting in Beelzebub's tales, like Beelzebub explains that various sacred individuals are actualized from above during the history, the course of human history, and even has sections. He talks about like Saint Jesus and Saint Buddha and or Saint Lama. I forget his terms for it, but he talks about Moses and Jesus and Lama and Krishna. So he talks about these different saints as being beings that have actualized from above at different points in human history to help humankind move forward and to try to stop the processes of reciprocal destruction and also animal sacrifice. So in Gurdjieff's book, there have been a series of sacred individuals who have played such a role at different periods in human history.
Mm-hmm.
And Gurdjieff himself, like, he grew up, I think it would now be part of Turkey, like in Asia Minor there.
Yeah.
And he traveled, like he traveled into Tibet and Egypt and Northern Africa and through the Middle East. Like he traveled widely for like 20 to 30 years with a group of people seeking out different secret societies and brotherhoods and things like that. So he traveled widely and his history is largely unknown. Like he disappeared for a long, long period through these travels. He is also seen quite familiar with Sufi teachings, but many things in his teachings are really quite unique to Gurdjieff. For instance, the Enneagram we talked about last time, Don, that's not associated with any other mystical teachings, and it's that kind of profound symbol which Gurdjieff dates to pre-Egyptian times. Like he says, it even comes down from Atlantean times. Like in Beelzebub's tales, Gurdjieff talks about the submersion of Atlantis and how the initiates had known it was happening and they kind of reseeded Africa and Asia. And so you had this brotherhood. Like he talks about how the pyramids and things in Egypt really were built by the society, this kind of secret society that goes back to Atlantean times. So Gurdjieff himself, like, he seemed quite widely studied. He was also influenced by, classical or Greek Orthodox Christianity.
Yes.
He described his fourth way teaching as a form of esoteric Christianity, so mm-hmm. kind of mystical Christianity.
I think his name was, now you mentioned Turkey. I think he was more from the area near Georgia, part of the Russian Empire. And he was, it was known as an Armenian territory. But he came from a Greek and American background. So
a Greek and Armenian. I meant
to say Armenian. I'm sure.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, American.
Yeah. He spoke Greek and Armenian. Too.
Yeah. And I'm quite familiar with the Orthodox version of Christianity, mm-hmm. and so I can sympathize with that in a way. And I know a lot about the Armenian people as well. I have many Armenian friends, and I got into a lot of their history with them. So I understand the spirit of the individual, and that gives me, you know, a clear image of what influenced him. But you see, he brought out this, he brought out the same sorts of questions or challenged the status quo in the Orthodox Christian Church that I did myself. And there were many times when a priest couldn't really answer a question or wasn't willing to answer a question that I would ask. You know, why did the Catholic Church form out of the Orthodox Church? And what are their differences? Or, you know, their disagreements? And
interesting, in Gurdjieff's book about his meetings with remarkable men, which is partly autobiographical, he talks about a similar thing, like as a youth, observing certain phenomena which were inexplicable. And one was like how these native people could draw a circle around someone and that person wouldn't be able to escape a circle. Different phenomena here. And he kind of searched out, like going to the priests and the scholars, and like no one could answer his questions. And that's kind of what set him off to dissatisfied with the kind of Orthodox church and Orthodox explanations of things.
Well, the reason I mention that, Christopher, is because I find that the overwhelming feeling I had when I asked that question and got that non-responsive response was that I felt like something was being hidden, intentionally hidden. Information was being withheld, you know? I think a well-meaning person or one who didn't have something to hide, you know, posing as a priest, would say, you know, I don't know the answer to that question, but I'll see if I can find that out. But it was more a defensive posturing that, well, there's really no difference between Orthodox and Catholic Christianity. And then I asked the question, well, then why don't we say Hail Marys in the Orthodox Church? You know, why have these organized religions developed rituals? What do those rituals have to do with the reality of Christ and what he taught? And they couldn't answer that.
Interesting. Also, another in Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's Tales, he talks about the role of Hasdamas individuals through history who invented their own religions. These kind of false belief system, like the, I would say today we have these kind of New Agey teachings and such, which I would say is like a Hasdamas science. And also the Hasdamas through history, they always distorted religious teachings and divided people into factions and sects. So kind of always creating division within religion. So that's another role that he saw as Hasdamas is playing through history, and that led to the kind of degradation of the religious traditions.
Yeah, well, I'm in no way comparing myself to Gurdjieff, other than to say that I get the general sense that he came out of a similar experience to my own.
Yeah.
You describe very eloquently and accurately the way he communicated these short sentences, 2-3 words, and you think you're actually listening to somebody who just arrived at Ellis Island and is explaining to the INS agent who he is and trying to speak English. You know, it's sort of like broken English, but then you see. No, he intentionally left the articles out of this word or a sentence. He didn't need to embellish the words. He just used the words that lead to the path of consciousness.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah. It's a nice description. And he uses words in a different way slightly that breaks the usual associations of words. And it's quite unique, his use of language. And even reading Beelzebub's Tales, like you learn his whole other language. Like I could tell you about, you know, how the sacred law of Triamazikamno and Heptapar Parshanok maintain the great autotrogo auto-egocratic process and things like that. You know, so it's like this whole other language. And part of that is he makes it different, so that it kind of, you can't read it in the usual way. He called a telescope is a tescueno, and our solar system is out of ores, and it's a whole language, and you have to work at the book. Like it's not something you can. It's not light reading, and it actually develops something in you to be able to read and understand the book.
I've seen, as
I've read it at different times in my life, how much more is revealed to me. And then this is my newest edition of the Slugs, eh? And what particularly I focused on this time was I realized how what he was saying about the Hasnamas individuals and the causes of war, and then he talks about all the different kinds of crats, like the aristocrats and the plutocrats and the theocrats. And these are like different kinds of Hasnamas individuals. They're the power-possessing beings, you know. And he has one point, a whole thing on, he talks about the League of Nations. Like his grandson, Hussein, says, Beelzebub, why can't these three-brained beings resolve and stop this awful process of war? You know, why can't they get together? So he talks about the League of Nations and why nothing ever comes of these societies and how they always get twisted around. And in the end, it's always the power-possessing beings wanting to make money as stock jugglers, he calls them. It's like they, you know, and the bigger the war, then the more money they can make, and you know, how their motives become so distorted. And he says these societies, none of them have people of being in them who have obtained objective levels in the development of their being. Like, you look at all these trilateral commission and all these societies they have, and you know, they have their secret meetings, and they all think they're so special, and they got all their little sex slaves and boys and girls and things that they carry on and party and do all the awful things they do. It's like there aren't beings in it who have true being. Or the UN, you know, it's not. Like, I heard, have you ever heard this? I heard the other day on a show that David Rockefeller apparently supplied young boys to members of the United Nations. Have you ever heard that maintained?
I've heard that story before, and it wouldn't surprise me. You know, we had the Pageboy incident that came out some 20 years ago or so, and it comes out every once in a while in the U.S. Congress as well. But yeah. See, I think that's intended to deflect the attention on the Franklin cover-up, to tell you the truth, which is even bigger.
I guess what I was going to say, though, but in a way, like, if that's true about the UN, and I can totally see it, because here's this totally corrupted, that this body is supposed to be the basis of world government, and it's totally criminally corrupted and controlled by these elites. I missed what I was going to say about this.
You were talking about...
And then you hear, like, that lady Kay Beggs, who was married to a top military guy at the Pentagon. And she was describing all these guys, they have their kind of the homosexuality, and they have their parties with wife swapping, and they have their prostitutes and girls, and it's this whole style of drugs and free sex, and that, like, people think, oh, our top military people, you know, they must be men of integrity, but no, it's completely the opposite. They're the most self-indulgent, depraved people. You know, and she talks about how, you know, all these people who come in for NATO, and they're put up in hotels, and they bring, oh, Filipino men and call the bottoms for them, you know, and it's like, that's what they do. You know, you get all these NATO guys, like, why isn't NATO, you know, the idea of having a unified defense is something valuable, but then it becomes so distorted, and these people who arise to power in NATO, you know, this is the whole thing. It's a part of it. It is this kind of sex life and slaves and drugs and indulgence and all this is so much a part of our military. They're not men of honor and integrity. They'll put 100,000 American young men and women in jeopardy while they live that lifestyle, living in a lie and acting treasonous all the time. You know.
Yeah. And You already described the nature, and Gurdjieff described the nature of the warmongers, didn't he? We did that at the top of the show. You did. So we should expect it. You've described them as being soulless beings and deprived of any sense of morality and goodness. you know, pure evil. What else can we expect? Yet we somehow honor that blindly, stupidly, foolishly. Well, that's the subconscious taking over for the conscious, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's like the more pathological someone is, the more they attain to power. And Gurdjieff's whole analysis of the Hasnamasas really applies to understanding the psychopathology of these people who think they're elites. You know, he calls them power-possessing beings and Hasnamasas, and he talks about their Hasnamasian science. This is the opening quote of the book. Do you mind if I read that, Don?
No, go ahead.
He says, Hasnamasian, he's talking about one of the two things you need to do to stop war. Like, what practical things could we do? He's asked at one point by his grandson. He says, one thing, you gotta stop making heroes and giving honors to those involved in warfare, because that, you know, it kind of, you see that in America, you know, they make a Hollywood movie making it sound as though Americans going overseas are, you know, spreading democracy and protecting people and spreading justice, when the whole time it's just all a sham based on lies. And usually they're wars against people of foreign lands so that the elites can seize the power and resources of those lands. But the American people are just completely deceived through the media. And we make big heroes of these people. So he sees that as one thing we could do. And he says another thing we have to get rid of, he says, Hasnamasian science invented by certain pimpled beings among them, in which it is nonchalantly proved that the periodic reciprocal destruction on the earth is very, very necessary, and that if it did not exist, an intolerable overpopulation would result on the earth, and such economic horrors would ensure that men beings would begin to eat one another. Now, in a way, that's like totally bizarre, but in a way, it's like totally true to what is happening in the world with all these, you know, you just stick, you know, gates in there with the certain pimpled beings among them. You know, it's like all these elites, they think they have to reduce the world's population, but they don't want to, you know, they want to reduce other people's population. You know, Gates and Buffett and all these people, and the eugenicists and the Rockefellers and the UN Agenda 21. This is what Gurdjieff was saying in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. But I guess even back then you had the Rockefeller eugenics program, which had spread to Europe and was being carried out in America. So I couldn't believe finding that this time in reading the book.
Yeah, he certainly was aware of what was going on and hasn't changed. It's gotten worse. And despite the fact that this information is there for us to learn the lesson from. Christopher, we're about out of time, but I want you to share the information, the best way that someone can order this book. Why did you name it The Slugs, by the way? I want to ask you that.
Oh, well, has to do with a funny incident in the book where Beelzebub has been telling his grandson, Hassin, about these strange three-brained beings on planet Earth. And at one point he makes a comment that their skin is slightly more oily than ours. So at a later point, Hassin is trying to refer back to those three-brained beings on planet Earth, but he doesn't know what to refer to them as. And so he uses the word slugs. And then Beelzebub says, well, he doesn't know. And then he realizes, Hassin meant those three-brained beings on planet Earth. And then he tells this story to Hassin about what those beings would do if they ever heard him call them slugs. And all the things that they would do to him. And it's this kind of bizarre incident in the tales.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took that word, his use describing us as slugs. But it also applies because he's kind of like saying three brain beings on planet Earth don't attain to their true humanness. They kind of die like they're like slugs, you know. They can attain higher levels of being development and afterlife existence, but none of them are attaining their souls anymore. Instead, they only feed the Earth and the Moon. And so in the way they die like dog, or they die like slugs or lower life form, he says, as one and two brain beings die.
I see.
So that's part of the why slugs.
Well, thank you for answering that question. Of course, read the book. Now, tell the folks how they can get the book, and I want to share another musical message before we say goodnight.
Right. Good. Okay. If people go to my website at zeropoint.ca, you can order all the books directly from me, and or you can order them through Amazon. And at the moment, actually, Psychological Illusions, one of my two books on Gurdjieff, is not going to be available again for another 4 days because I did a further edit on it and switched it a little bit, the formatting. But the slugs and my book on Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine and the Heart Doctrine, I have four books available through Amazon. So either directly through me or through Amazon.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you being on Evident Footprints. Before I say goodnight, will you join me in listening to this young 7-year-old, Rayma Marvan, sing The Star-Spangled Banner?
Wow.
Now that everyone's heart is opened. And this is, I think, I categorize this myself. I don't know this for a fact, but I assume that this was sort of a dry run in a recording studio where she's using the Whitney Houston arrangement that was featured on a Super Bowl some years ago. And she's sort of mimicking Whitney, but this technique is just amazing, and the feeling that comes through. This is our little angelic messenger, Rayma Marvan.
Oh, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the past
Marvan. And she
wow, what a powerhouse she is, eh? That was sweet. How she hit those high notes is beautiful.
Well, I'm going to try to get her on the show as soon as possible. And I made some contact with the folks that are managing her career. And what a night that'll be when she comes
on. Wow.
So I'll let everybody know when that's going to happen as soon as I find out. But I appreciate you allowing me to share this little angel with the listeners, Christopher, along with your message tonight.
Well, I think both songs are most appropriate to what we're talking about, and it's a beautiful anthem. I love the American anthem, and hey, the land of the free, home of the brave. Hey, it's so tragic what's been done to America, you know, and I just pray that Americans are going to wake back and take back their country, and you know, if we could ever deal with these international criminal cabals around the world and take back the resources of the world, it would lead to a whole new era in the United States and around the world. You know, if we could ever have justice on this planet, you know, all these elites would be imprisoned, and it would wipe out the debts of the United States in a day. Like, otherwise, you know, your generations of Americans would be slaves for the next century, you know?
Yes.
But if you arrested the true terrorists of our time, it would eliminate the debt of the United States. You could get rid of taxes, even though I agree with some taxes, but not to the Federal Reserve, a bunch of banksters. It's so tragic what's been done to America, and yet there's still hope. And you know, I see it really important is this kind of awakening of consciousness around the world and the awakening of the heart. And we need to reach out across nations, you know, whether it's Jews or Muslims or Christians or Hindus or whatever, you know, people of heart around the world. We need to become responsibility and take responsibility for facing these crises of our times. Thanks. I really appreciate being on your show, Don, and I always love your show.
Well, I love your show as well, and I appreciate having you and enjoy having you on this show, and so do the listeners. I get lots of nice compliments about your work, and I want to encourage folks to investigate the works of Christopher Holmes, Ph.D. Go to ZeroPoint.ca, listen to his show, Zero Point, on BBS Radio, Station 1, on Saturdays, and I should say every other Saturday.
Don, if I could just mention one other thing, it might be of interest to some readers. I'm going to be on Rick Adams' Small Evening with Dr. K, and I'm doing some original research on this no plane issue, because in regards to 9/11, I think the images of the plane were completely fabricated in the corporate media studios. The whole thing was enacted out. And I've been doing an analysis of this September Clues series, and I'm coming out with an article on that. So I'm sure it will be an interesting show. I'll just be on there for half an hour with Rick and Dr. K tomorrow.
Well, give them my best. They've both been on this show many times, and they're doing great work, too, as well.
Yeah, they are.
Christopher, got to say goodnight, but thank you so much. I want to remind our listening audience and you that Christopher Holmes will be with us again on November 30th, last day of the month. So be sure to tune in for that show. Again, thank you, Christopher. I wish you the best. Be safe. Keep up the good work. And I'll be reading your and studying your The Slug's workbook. You have my word on that.
Thanks, Don. Goodbye.
That wraps it up, folks. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our guest, Christopher Holmes, Ph.D. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world over at BBS Radio tonight. I want to thank Seth Hendrick on the sound, Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me tomorrow night when my special guest will be former U.S. Marine and host of A Marine's Disquisition, Drew Malone Reigns III. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.